talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. Today is May 15th. And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
Kate Marquis.
And welcome. It is the day after Mother's Day. Did you guys go and visit your mothers on Mother's Day?
I did.
I maybe drew some mothers yesterday at the farm. That was about it.
Oh, good. I went to the Powell Hall and saw Singing in the Rain with the symphony. Oh, there was a lot of mothers there.
Oh, my goodness.
My daughter and I were celebrating Father's Day early, I guess, because we didn't take a mother.
A lot of corsages imbued at Singing.
My mother fell and broke her wrist on Mother's Day. I feel bad for her.
That's a shame.
Yeah, she'll live. She's a tough bird.
Yeah, she put up with you.
That's right. All right, let's get started on talking about movies because we got a lot of movies to review.
Oh, yeah.
12 at the box office. Let's zip through this really quick. Number 12 was Gifted with 1.3. Number 11 was Bahubali, The Conclusion. That was on there last week, 1.5. Met Opera, A Fathom Event, was number 10 with 1.7. The Circle is number 9 with 1.7. Lowriders, that's probably over Ronnie's.
Oh, really?
That's got Damien Bircher.
Yeah.
And it's about, East L.A., guys who drive their cars around. And
it's, produced by Ava Longoria. No, she's in it.
She's in it. Yeah,
Ava Longoria, yeah.
I didn't know anything about it until I saw it on this.
I didn't even know it was playing anywhere here.
Yep. And How to Be a Latin Lover is number 7 with $3.7 million. We almost saw that, but that's only showing over at the West Olive, and I don't like that theater anymore.
Oh, really?
Beauty and the Beast is number 6 with $3.8. Boss Baby is number 5 with $4.6. Fate of the Furious, number 4 with $5.3. King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, made $14.7 million, which doesn't sound too bad until you realize that it cost $175 million to make. It's gonna be in the red.
It ain't going up. It ain't going up from here.
Snatched was number 2. It did a little better, 17.5. That was probably the Mother's Day movie to see. That was a good weekend to release it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
They actually reissued Mother's Day with Jennifer Aniston in
a bunch
of theaters. It's in a bunch of theaters right now. But it didn't do well enough to make the top.
You want to punish your mother, take care of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, Guardians of the Galaxy is still number 1, and it made $63.007 million. Dollars,
so. Well, I tell you, the happiest thing, real quick story, the happiest thing about the Guardian success is a writer named Bill Mantlow created the character Rocket Raccoon, and he was injured in a rollerblading accident in 92, been in a skilled care facility all this time until last week Marvel bought him a house right next to his brother's place. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you show thanks to the creators of your properties.
A skateboarding accident?
No, rollerboard. Rollerblading.
Rollerblading.
Yeah, hit-and-run rollerblading. Was in a coma for a long time. He's got brain trauma, brain injury. Yeah. But like I say, he's been in the skilled care home since then. His brother's been taking care of him, so they bought him a house next to his brother's place. Mm. So good for Marvel. Good for them.
Yeah. And that's much better Mother's Day movie anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's got a good mother theme.
Yes.
All right, Alien Covenant opens Friday. That's probably going to be number 1 this weekend, I would assume. That'll be Guardians.
Guardians will shoot down to number 2, but no tears for them.
What else opens?
now that movie's paid for itself, at more so than King
And then Carter what's will. This Everything, does that open Friday?
Yeah.
They're showing that to us tomorrow night.
It looks like it. I was hoping we were going to get to dodge that one.
What a terrible title, Everything. What does that even mean?
I've endured that trailer a couple of times at screenings, and it just
The Girl
mawkish.
In the Plastic Bubble would have been a better title.
The Girl in the Plastic Bubble has the fault in her stars.
It's the same kind of thing.
So let's get going. We got a bunch of movies to review, and a couple of people died. There's lots of stuff going on locally, so let's start. Let's start with Snatched. Jim, you're the only one in the room who's seen Snatched, though.
Yeah,
it did quite well with $17.5 million. Dollars. Is it any good?
I thought you were going to check it out this week. I guess you'd make it over to
it. It's funny. I Friday night, Emma and I, she's my 17-year-old, we're going to go to a movie, and I could not talk her into seeing Snatched.
Hmm.
So we ended up seeing Slight, which I'll review here in a minute. Just because we couldn't agree on anything, so we kind of saw something that nobody wanted to see.
It's a compromise.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I do want to see Snatched.
Hola. Check in for Middleton.
What's this? Hey,
Mom, welcome.
Whale, what?
Welcome.
Welcome.
They're not serving
whale
semen.
Baby.
I've got it.
Sort of like they talk about it.
Yeah, I guess I'm in the minority. I think it's only around 38-37% at Rotten Tomatoes. It depends on how you feel about Amy Schumer. I still think she's very charming. I really enjoy her her Comedy Central show, and she's not exactly playing the same character she played in Trainwreck, which was an unexpected hit from a couple of summers ago, but she's is playing a variation of her stand-up character, this sort of flighty girl woman, I guess, as opposed to the boy man that actors like Seth Rogen and Adam Sandler have played. She's just kind of cruising through life. At the opening scene, she gets fired from her retail job. She gets dumped by her boyfriend. But the unfortunate thing, well, besides getting dumped publicly by the boyfriend, is the fact that they were planning a vacation. She had bought
Who plays the boyfriend?
The boyfriend is Randall Park. It's a very it's a quick scene, but it's very funny. And that's just one of the good things about this film, as opposed to a lot of comedies. You should, sometimes they'll just save all the funny bits for the main actors. Here, they're spreading the laughs all around. They've got a lot of really talented people in supporting roles. So she gets dumped with the boyfriend, but they had bought two non-refundable tickets to Ecuador. And so she's dealing with that, and she decides to go to her mom's to sort of nurse her wounds from all that's going on. And her mom is played by Goldie Hawn, and this is her first film in 15 years since the Banger Sisters in 2002. And she is playing a woman named Linda, who's kind of repressed. She's on her way to becoming a cat lady. She's got a couple of cats she talks about, and she's got multiple locks on her front door. It's kind of like the joke from the original producers with Max Bialikstock, one of his investors. And she's kind of all sheltered, and their daughter breezes through, and Amy's character Emily goes through the closet and finds this scrapbook and sees all these photos of her mom on different adventures in Paris and London. And here we get a chance to see Goldie during her golden time during the 70s and 80s and all that, so that's kind of nice. And convinces her, well, Mom, you can go on the trip with me. So they go to Ecuador.
Do they show her in her bikini from Laugh-In?
No, but we do get to see a little bit of the dancing Goldie by the end of the film, so that's nice. So they go down to Ecuador, and they're having a pretty good time, except they're clashing right away, and Emily has to get away and goes to a bar and gets picked up by this suave British guy, and they have a nighttime adventure, and everything's wonderful. And he says, I tell you what, tomorrow morning I'll take you and your mother out on a daytime adventure. And the Linda, the Goldie character, is very skeptical, especially when they start driving through these sort of scary parts of the country. They're kind of rough parts, you'd say. All of a sudden, their Jeep gets rammed by a van, and Emily and Linda lose consciousness. They wake up, and they're in some sort of dank concrete bunker, and they've been kidnapped. They're going to be held for ransom by some drug kingpins down in Colombia, is where they get transported to. And they contact Emily's brother, Jeffrey, who has stayed behind, who's played by Ike Barinholtz, and he's sort of an agoraphobic, really needy guy, and he's trying to deal with this this fellow on the phone who's asking for $100,000 for them. And of course, then they escape, and it's all about them trying to get out of the country. And I thought it was very funny. I think that that Amy and Goldie have a believable chemistry. You can accept that that they could be mother and daughter.
It's rated R. Is it raunchy?
It is very raunchy. I should mention that. It certainly earns its R rating. There's a lot of jokes about sex and bodily functions. But like I say, what makes up for some of the raunch is some of the great, the wordplay in it. It's the screenplay is by Kate Dippold, who was one of the, wrote the Ghostbusters reboot from last year. So she's very good. She's a very good writer. It's directed by Jonathan Levine, who I enjoyed his work as director of 50-50 a couple of years ago and the night before. And I should mention with some of the people that they encounter, they run into Chris Maloney, who's best known for Law & Order SVU on TV in these serious roles, is very funny as this sort of Indiana Jones wannabe who's going to guide them through the jungle. Very funny. Also, there's a pair of ladies that they stumbled upon in the hotel, played by Wanda Sykes and her friend Barb, who she insists is a special ex-special ops agent. Barb is played by Joan Cusack in a mute performance. Her character does not speak, and that's explained in the film. And it's kind of reminiscent of some of the silent comedians, a little bit of Harpo Marx in there. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I was laughing hard through the whole thing, and it's got a good moral behind it. Emily, the Amy Schumer character, learns to be more responsible and not take her mother for granted. And Linda, you know, is reminded to go out and take a chance, and you've got a choice between you know, getting older and becoming old, really, and giving up on things.
Okay, so how many stars did you give it when you reviewed it?
I gave it 4.5.
4.5 out of 5. Oh, my gosh. You really liked Snap. And Kate and I have not seen it yet, but I'm going to see it. It does look mildly amusing. Let's move on. I could not talk Emma into seeing Snatched. So we went over to the Galleria and we saw Slight, which actually opened over a week ago.
I had no idea that this movie had opened, really.
Well, this is turning into something I would have never signed up for. I never thought it'd get dangerous. I just wish I could move Tina to a neighborhood with a better school, surrounded by better people.
You got my money?
Don't mess up, man!
I gave you a job when you needed it most.
I'm gonna kill you and every person you know.
Yeah, Slight is written and directed by a guy named J.D. Dillard. And it's a very low-budget film, and it's about a teenager. I guess he's maybe 18 or 19, and his name's Bo. And the movie opens with him learning about the death of his mother, and he's got a little sister who's 10 or 11. So he has to, you know, take care of her as a single parent, but he's not really a parent; he's a brother. But I don't know what we don't know where the father is. So he they're basically orphans living together. His hobby is magic, and he makes money by standing on the street corner doing card tricks and levitating things. And he also makes money by selling drugs. He's a drug dealer as well, and his supplier is sort of the local drug boss, and then this other local drug gang tries to move into the neighborhood to take over some of their turf. Bo is hired by his boss to go cut off the hand of the leader of the other drug gang, which I thought was going to be like a magic trick, but it wasn't. He really cuts off the guy's hand with a meat cleaver. It's kind of bizarre. This movie is... I can't imagine this movie costing more than maybe $3 or $4 or $5 million to make. It's released by Blumhouse Studios, which does a lot of low-budget horror movies, gets them into the theaters, makes a bunch of money. This one apparently did well enough that they've carried it over. I think this is the third week they've actually carried this over in St. Louis. It's at 3 or 4 cinemas, although there's only 2 other people in the audience.
Really?
When Emma and I saw it, but unfortunately, it's not very good. I was hoping that they would really focus on the magic and the hobby and the art of magic, and it's not. It's really this sort of melodrama about this drug dealer and dealing with his boss who wants to kill him because he gets double crossed. And then he meets this girlfriend and she moves in and she's got bruises all over her back because she comes from an abused home. And it goes on and on and all. And the whole magic is something of an afterthought, and it gets really ridiculous. He's got this electromagnet that he's installed in his arm, so he can levitate like rings and, you know, jewelry and coins somehow. But then at some point, the rival drug gang kidnaps his little 10-year-old sister, so he has to go into action. So he brings in his mentor, and his mentor says, well, let's adjust this electromagnet that you've installed in your arm and make it super powerful. So when he goes to confront the drug dealers, they're shooting at him, and like the bullets are stopping a foot from his face and turning around and going back towards the drug dealers, which is just ridiculous. I wish they would have. I just get the impression that the people who made this movie, the people who wrote this movie, don't know anything about magic. I wish it would have been about the art of magic. Maybe gotten a magician like somebody on the lines of Ricky Jay as a consultant on this thing, because that's ridiculous. You've never seen Bill Bixby and the Magician doing something like that. That's comic book territory.
That's X-Men stuff.
Well, if Tony Stark did that, you'd accept it because it's a comic book. But this wants to have it both ways. This wants to be a gritty look at life on the streets, and it's pretty realistic up until that point. It's a missed opportunity. And like I said, the magic, which is supposed to be at the center of the film, really isn't. There's a couple of scenes where he's on a street corner doing these card tricks and these coin tricks, etc. But that's a pretty small part of the movie. It's really a melodrama, and it's not very good. It's not very well written, and Jacob Lattimore, who stars as Bo, really gives a performance that's just so low key. It comes off as sort of amateurish. All the acting in this movie is sort of amateurish.
Yeah, we last saw him in that Collateral Beauty, that Will Smith misfire from last Christmas. Yeah.
Jacob Lattimore.
Yeah, he was one of the sort of angel characters in it or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, this movie only runs about 85 minutes, so it's not a dull film, but I don't really recommend it. It's not nearly as good as I was hoping it would be. And doggone it, Emma, we should have gone and seen Snatched.
Yes, I think you would have gotten some laughs.
Yeah, so had I reviewed it for WeirdMovieGeeks.com, I would have given it maybe 1.5 or 2 stars out of 5. Slight. I do not recommend Slight. It's a slight film. All right, let's move along. The Lover.
I've hardly seen you this week.
I've been overly occupied.
So you're screwing your wife now?
As if.
Stars Deborah Winger, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Did you guys both see it?
We both saw it. Yeah. It opens this Friday, doesn't it?
Right, and I'm going to do the review.
All right.
So I thought it was very funny. It's very slyly funny. It's a long-married couple who are both cheating on each other. Deborah Winger plays the wife, whose name is Mary, and Tracy Letts plays her husband, Michael. And Aidan Gillen and Melora Walters play their younger lovers, Robert and Lucy.
Oh, isn't Aidan Gillen and
King Arthur, yes.
Yeah, and he's also in Game of Thrones.
Oh, that right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So if you watch that, and people probably recognize him more from that. So it's structured kind of like a classic farce. So there's a lot of misunderstandings or secrets or near misses. But the reason why it's funny is because of the excellent performances, particularly Tracy Letts and Deborah Winger are just wonderful as this long married couple who, they know they're not getting along, but, they don't say anything about the people they're cheating on. And then there's a kind of, they're not really sure about the people they're cheating on.
Yeah.
It's very sly. It's very clever. It twists a lot of assumptions about older people. And there's a lot of bed hopping, which you don't usually expect to see for people who are on the edge of old age, more than middle age. And it's written and directed by a fellow named Azel Jacobs, who's the... it's very funny, but it's very sly, very clever, very low key sort of comedy, and it's mostly in the performance.
Who directed this movie?
Oh, let's say is this Jacobs fellow?
Jacobs, yeah.
Jacobs.
He wrote it. He wrote it too.
Azel.
He
wrote and directed this, and this is I don't know, maybe his third or fourth film, it's really very, very clever, very well done, and very well structured. It's just very tongue in cheek.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I enjoyed, Tracy Letts, especially Deborah Winger in it.
Oh yeah.
Because
the two of them are great.
We talked about Goldie coming back, and Deborah's been doing supporting roles, but this is her first starring role in a long time. But I had some problems with it. The idea of sort of cheating on your the people you're having an affair with your husband or wife is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But I found that the affair people, the mistress and Mister, I guess would be, are kind of just not very entertaining characters. Kind of a drag.
I thought that was kind of the point because the people they're cheating with are not so exciting. You get the feeling those are also kind of long running relationships and maybe they're starting to wear down. Yeah. So it's like takes a lot of the assumptions that you would have about a cheating couple and turns them upside down.
Well, mention, though, that what sort of takes the fun out of the movie also is the impending visit and the visit itself by their son, by Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts' son, who's such a little brat
of
it,
You think that took the fun out of it. I thought that was amusing. I thought it added to it. I thought it was ridiculous. It was funny because it was ridiculous. Because it took all the assumptions, all the way that you usually see this kind of comedy done, and everything's turned around backwards.
How many stars are you going to give this movie here, Kate?
I think I'll probably give it 3.5 to 4. Probably 4.
Okay. Jim, if you were to have reviewed The Lovers, how many stars
would
you give it?
Probably 2.5 or 3, something like that.
All right. So Kate really liked The Lovers. Jim liked it a bit less. Let's move on. How about Jim gives us a real quick review of Whiskey Galore, which plays at Webster University this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7:30 p.m. Jim, is this movie any good?
It depends on how you feel about cute sort of Irish type, you know, aren't they adorable movies. It's actually based on a true instance. It's actually technically in Scotland. It's a island in Scotland during World War II, and a boat comes up on the reef there, and it's full of whiskey, and they've run out of whiskey on the Scottish island. So it's all about the villagers trying to get out there and get all the whiskey off this boat before it sinks, and about the government trying to stop them from doing it. It's got a very funny performance by Eddie Izzard as sort of the local guy that's trying to stop things. He you know, thinks he's a big representative of the government, but he really isn't. He's very funny. He's sort of in the Dean Wormer role, if you will, you know, from Animal House. And it's cute. It's got some nice costumes and, you know, sort of a feel to it. You know, early 40s, there's a subplot with these two young daughters of the postmaster looking to hook up with men in the village. But it's kind of a nice, you know, sort of slice of life in the 1940s in Scotland. So if you would enjoy that sort of thing, I think you'd get a kick out of it. I'm interested to see the 1949 original.
Mark Longdon will be reviewing it for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. He's already turned in his review. He gave it 2.5 stars. He didn't like it too much. He said it was just sort of... sort of blandly inoffensive, I think was the term he used. And apparently it's a remake of something from the Ealing Studios, like you mentioned. I guess Mark was familiar with that film and compared it unfavorably to the 1949 film Whiskey Galore. But good for Webster U for getting, you know, it looks like a movie that people who like those type of British comedies may enjoy. So good for Webster U for showing it.
Let's
move along then, shall we? Chuck opens Friday. Chuck.
Yeah.
Stars Liev Schreiber as Chuck Wepner.
Once upon a time, I was the heavyweight champ in New Jersey. When you feel nothing called, you're gonna I was the best.
Hey, Dal, set my man up with whatever he wants.
And some guy named Stallone wrote a screenplay inspired by me. I was like, what?
Chuck Wepner was a boxer from New York who fought Muhammad Ali in, I think, what, 1974, maybe, 73?
Yeah, something
and,
like that.
And Sylvester Stallone was familiar with Chuck Wepner's story and based Rocky very loosely, we should add, on the story of Chuck Wepner. There are a lot of similarities, though. Chuck Wepner was basically chosen because he was the highest-ranking white guy at the time, and Don King, after the rumble in the jungle with George Foreman, wanted Muhammad Ali to fight a white guy, and Chuck Wepner just happened to be the highest-ranked white guy that they could find. So Chuck was expected to last a round or two or three, but he ended up going almost the distance. And this is not a spoiler. This all happens in the first 30 minutes of the film.
He's the Bayonne Bleeder, they call him.
Yeah, the Bleeder. In fact, the original title of this movie was The Bleeder, which is probably a better title, the producers were afraid people think it was some kind of horror movie.
And Chuck hated that nickname, and they show that in the movie. Some guy said, "Hey, Bleeder, how you doing?" He's like, "What?"
But yeah, he does go. He doesn't go the distance, but he almost goes the distance. I think the fight is called like 30 seconds before the 15th round is completed. So, and he does knock down Muhammad Ali at one point, just like a Rocky knocked down Apollo Creed, and sure enough, Sylvester Stallone makes the movie, and then it goes on with his, you know, it's sort of a classic rags to relative riches, back to rags story. It was sort of a familiar story. Chuck, life starts to fall apart. He gets hooked on cocaine and hookers and things like that. They do show him seeing Rocky at the theater and said, "That's just what I said to my wife." They show him watching the Academy Awards on his TV and he's cheering on Rocky. And at one point, he sort of tracks down Sylvester Stallone. That's a really good scene, too. This guy named Morgan Spector plays a Stallone. He doesn't look a whole lot like him, but he sort of nails him. It's not a big part. And I kind of like the way Stallone comes off in this film. Stallone comes off as a really nice guy. And he even writes a role for Chuck in the first Rocky sequel. But by that, at that point, there's a whole scene where Chuck goes and auditions for this role. But at that point, he's so into drugs and he's just such a mess. I guess they wrote the part out. You know, he did not get that part. He did get. I looked him up on IMDb though, and he did have a few little roles in some films. This is a good movie. It's a nice movie. It's a little familiar, but it's still kind of an underdog story, and you root for this guy, and you like this guy, and Liev Schreiber is very good. I think Chuck Wepner was probably kind of wasn't very smart, and Liev Schreiber sort of exudes intelligence, so I think it's a tricky part for Liev to play. Chuck Wepner was also 6'5", which is about 5 inches taller than Mr. Schreiber. In fact, Chuck Wepner would have just been towering over Stallone at some point. But it's a very good movie, and Liev Schreiber is very good in the part, and he Naomi Watts plays this bartender that he sort of leaves his wife for. The wife is played by Elizabeth Moss, but she can't deal with his problems, so they eventually separate, and he ends up with Naomi Watts.
Yeah, there's a great scene in there where Elizabeth Moss's character walks into a diner where her husband is talking up some gal that he met in line at the movie theater earlier that evening, and she sort of lays out for her all that's going on with their marriage, and it's a really tough scene. My only problem with it is that the Naomi Watts character Linda, the bartender that he does end up with, is kind of underwritten. You don't kind of know why she's drawn to him. He calls her from the police station, and that's his one phone call, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense why she would gravitate towards him. She actually does say at one point, "I don't need this in my life right now," and then she changes her mind, and it's not quite shown in the film itself.
Yeah, well, who knows? And they're still together apparently. There's a little addendum at the end that shows the real Chuck. So it's a fine film. Apparently, this was a passion project for Liev Schreiber. I think he co-wrote it and produced it, and has been working on it for many, many years. And I think it's a from his point of view, it's a success. I think. So let's move on. I will be reviewing Chuck, and I'm going to give it probably 3.5 or maybe 4 stars when I review it for WeirdMovieGeeks.com.
Look for that
Thursday evening. All right, let's go. We still got 2 movies. Those are a couple of big ones. King Arthur was $175 million. It made a measly $17 million.
So lucky to get that.
$14 million dollars, exactly. Over the weekend. I reviewed King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, and I gave it 3 out of 5 stars.
It was Vortigern who murdered your father. But what you didn't account for is what you can do with this sword.
We need to be careful. His power is increasing.
I think it's sort of a fun movie.
Oh, way
while,
too generous.
While it's playing, it's kind of a fun movie. I like the fact that it's a fantasy. There was a version of King Arthur about 10 years ago with Clive Owen that was made by who directed it?
Anton Fuqua
that tried to do a realistic, earthy sort of version of King Arthur. This one takes the opposite tack and really plays up the fantasy elements. There's giant snakes and giant rats, and there's elephants that are 4.5 megascreens tall. They just stomp through the city at the beginning. And that stuff's pretty spectacular. It's a little over-directed. It's a little hyper. I think I said in my review, it's directed for the ADD generation where no shot can last more than a second and the camera always has to be moving and things like that. One problem I have with this, I'm not buying Charlie Hummin as a big screen movie star. This is the second movie I've seen him in. What was the other one? Pacific Rim.
Yeah, he was in The Lost City of Z.
I didn't see that. He didn't make any impression on me in Pacific Rim, and he didn't make much of an impression on me. Now, isn't he starring in this remake of Papillon that they're filming?
Oh, really?
Oh, my.
Yeah. He doesn't have a period presence. I said in my review, he's known for a TV show where he plays a biker, and he just still has that sort of surly biker swagger. He doesn't seem like someone from whenever that King Arthur took place, 17th century or whatever. When did King Arthur take place?
The 1200s, right? Oh, earlier than that.
That's what I meant. But some of the supporting actors are good. Jude Law plays his uncle, who is responsible for the death of his father, and he's quite good. And Jaimin Huntsu is good. And who's this guy we just mentioned? It was
Jaimin Huntsu plays Bedivere.
Yeah, but who's this other guy we just mentioned?
Oh, Aiden.
Aidan Gillen.
Oh yeah, Aidan Gillen. He's good. He's good as well. So there's some good supporting performances in this thing. It's a an origin story, so you don't get Merlin. Although you see Merlin briefly in one shot. Instead, you've got this woman named the Mage, and she's played by some mumbly-mouthed European model.
Astrid Burgess Frisbee.
Yeah, now what I read somewhere is that the original script had Merlin and it had Guinevere, and who won the Oscar for the Danish...
Vikander?
Alicia Vikander, who had worked with Michael
Ritchie. That would have
been worked
better.
With Guy Ritchie on... The Man from U.N.C.L.E. had expressed interest in playing Guinevere, and then at the last minute they just totally wrote out the Guinevere character, and they replaced Merlin with this Mage, so they'd have some woman in the movie. There's no romance for Arthur and Mage. There's no romance for Arthur, period. This is very much just one action scene after another. There's not much substance to it, but like I say, when you're watching it, it's pretty good. You'll go home and forget about it about an hour later. So I think it deserved my 3 out of 5 stars, and I think it deserves to do a little better than it's doing. And I think they're going to probably, even though it's going to bomb, I still suspect they're going to make a sequel because they have a lot of invested in it.
Straight to video.
I think Jim and I kind of disagree with that.
Oh, strongly.
I think part of the reason is that anybody who's fond of the King Arthur legend is not going to like this because he rearranges this. I mean, the characters' names are there, but a lot of the events are very different, how it plays out.
But the target audience isn't going to be familiar with the
well,
game.
I think
if
this is aimed towards teenagers.
And with that title, it's going to draw in people who are fans of the legend. What did you think, Jim?
Oh, I just thought it was just dreadful. I was bored out of my mind. I just thought they were just kind of going through the paces. A lot of it's ridiculous. Why do the mages need human beings in it? They could just take over the world with their powers. For goodness sakes, besides these humongous elephants, they're disintegrating people as they're marching towards them. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it just doesn't make a lot of sense, and I just kind of...
You're reading too much into it. It's spectacle.
It's showing off CGI, and you know.
I think it would have been more entertaining if they hadn't made it King Arthur. If they just made it some other king, some other story, and not tried to tie it to the legend, then I could have accepted it a lot easier. It's just a kind of, you know, fantasy, like you said. It could have been a video game derivative. But, you know, by actually tying it to the King Arthur legend, I thought that was a mistake to do that because it kind of puts up an expectation. And if you'd started with more of a clean slate, you know, I would have found it more entertaining. You might have found it less irritating.
Yeah, I just didn't care much about the characters in it. I disagree about Jude Law. He's just kind of sneering through most of the thing, and just being the cad twirling his mustache. And Eric Bana is kind of wasted in the flashbacks as the father. And the stuff about the sword, this ridiculous thing that it can stop time or something.
Yeah.
It sometimes it can stop time. Sometimes it could just make King Arthur faint. Dead away.
Yeah, that was kind of odd.
Yeah, so it's just kind of a mess. The whole thing.
You have
thing.
To blame Guy Ritchie for this.
I think this is a better film than his Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Barely.
I mean, I wasn't bored with this film. This film runs under about 1 hour and 50 minutes. I think it moves pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of his Sherlock Holmes films. So.
I'm not a fan of those either, especially
the
second one.
I actually liked those, but I just didn't.
Well, that at least had Robert Downey Jr., who's a very charismatic star at the center of them. This one is lacking a good movie star.
Well, and that had some humor. This doesn't have much humor.
And Jude Law's a better Watson in those.
Yeah.
All right. So I liked King Arthur, you know, sort of, to an extent I liked it. I gave it 3 out of 5, and these guys liked it substantially less than I did. Let's move on. Are we down to our last movie? I think we are. Nobody saw The Wimpy Kid.
Yeah.
Flibbity flabbity flew. Alien Covenant.
Covenant, do you read me? Covenant.
What's happening?
That opens this Friday. That
I guess
the,
we can talk about that.
Is this the, I guess this is the, I don't know, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th? Yeah, I guess if you count the Alien versus Predator movies, if you count Prometheus, this will be
number
8.
You count Prometheus. Mm-hmm. They were dancing around that before Prometheus came out. Yeah. Well, it's not a prequel. Yeah, it's a prequel.
It was a total prequel. And this is a sequel to Prometheus and a prequel to the first Alien. So this falls between. Actually, I think it takes place, I think they even say 5 or 6.
Ten years after Prometheus.
10 years after Prometheus. And, who was the Swedish actress that was in?
Oh, or Naomi Rapace.
Yeah, she's. I was kind of hoping she would be in this film.
Well, she's kind of in this film.
Yeah. Well,
giving away a whole lot. Yeah. See some shots of her, but
yeah.
I did kind of like the cast of this film. We reviewed a movie a couple months ago called Life, which was very similar to the Alien series, and I complained about how bland all the characters were, bland and interchangeable all the characters were. I think this does a better job having a crew that's interesting.
Billy
Crudup is the captain. I thought, I don't know if you noticed in close-ups, I thought he looked a lot like Tom Skerritt. In the original Alien, you put a droopy mustache on him, he would have looked just like Tom.
Well, I think the film was peppered with little references to the original Alien.
Yeah, before the film came out, we saw these pictures of Kathleen Waterston, posing like Ripley from the first two movies. You know,
that's one of them.
Yeah, and she's good.
The sound.
And,
the
she's got
music.
Little to do in it, though.
Yeah, Michael Fassbender is really sort of the star of this film. He does this thing where he's playing two characters, but a lot of times actors will do that and they'll go out of their way to differentiate the two characters. He kind of does the opposite, and the script requires him to.
And there's a 5-minute scene where one of them teaches the other one how to play the flute, and I'm like, get on with it!
That scene didn't bother me.
Oh, it did. I was like, it just went on forever.
I liked all the interaction between Michael Fassbender and himself. no, that was clever.
And that interlude at the beginning of Michael Fassbender's android characters.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting. Yeah. But fewer music lessons, please.
Yeah.
Well, I think they were trying to, create that Fassbender character as a kind of old-fashioned Renaissance man, or more specifically, a Victorian gentleman who was skilled in all kinds of things and cultivated. Mm. And I think that was what they were trying to create.
Oh, well.
So Michael Hafner is reviewing this. I didn't talk to Michael Hafner, so I don't know if he liked it or not. He'll be reviewing it for We Are Movie Geeks Thursday night. If I was going to review it, I'd probably give it 3.5, maybe 4 stars. It's a darn entertaining movie. It's got a lot of violence and gore and aliens and everything people are going to want in an alien movie.
And everything they've seen way too many times before.
I think the fans of the franchise are going to be pleased, and I think this movie's actually going to do very, very well. I think people are looking forward to this movie, and they're not going to be let down.
Well, I think this is a franchise that needs to end or take a different direction. That's for
sure. Well, it took a different direction with the Predator versus Alien movies, and those were lousy, so I think this is kind
it
of
took a different direction with Aliens.
I think this is a return to form. I think this is probably the best Alien movie since Aliens. Much better than that fourth one.
I'm not keen on the third one. That's sort of gotten a reputation over the years. It's gotten a little bit of a following. The fourth one with Winona Ryder, there's some moments in that I enjoy.
Yeah,
and the fact that Sigourney Weaver's in it, too, is pretty great. But
all right. Well, we are done, I think, reviewing movies. Locally, there's always a lot of stuff going on. Planet of the Vampires. That's Mario Bamba's 1963 sci-fi movie that's showing as part of Late Night Grindhouse this Friday and Saturday at midnight over at the Moolah, Planet of the Vampires. I think Andy's trying to make a point about how the Alien series sort of lifted some of the iconography from Planet of the Vampires. And that's true to a point. But Planet of the Vampires is a very slow-paced Mario Bava movie. I'm not sure if Andy's audience is going to dig it the way they do some of the gorier stuff. But we'll see.
Color's pretty good at it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I imagine. I mean, I got the Blu-ray, and the Blu-ray looks spectacular. When we were growing up, this movie was called Demon Planet when it played on TV all the time back in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then The Dark Knight is at the Tivoli. The Dark Knight is the Batman movie that Heath Ledger won the Oscar for.
And he's the main reason to see that film. Yeah. He's the best thing in it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Sure there'll be a big turnout for that.
There might be. We showed my neighbor Totoro over the weekend, and we had a big turnout for that. But those Miyazakis always pack them in. It's hard to predict the midnight shows at the Tivoli. It's hard to predict how many people are going to show up. I always think something's going to be a big hit, and it's not. I thought the Jackie Chan movie would pack them in, and I was wrong. And then I thought 2001 Space Odyssey nobody would show up for, and I was wrong. They had over 100 people. So who knows? Unfortunately, I got an email from Hugh Ronsky, who was the regional manager for Landmark, and they are pausing the Midnight Series. I was hoping to announce the new Midnight lineup because The Dark Knight is the last one on this current schedule, and he says, we think the Midnight movie series might do better if we don't do it every weekend. So they're going to pause it. He claims he's going to bring it back in the fall. I sure hope they do. The Midnight Series of the Tivoli is a St. Louis institution. I saw my first Midnight movie at the Tivoli in 1978. Mm-hmm. And I've been hosting the Midnight Series at the Tivoli for almost 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And I always show up and hand out swag and do trivia. And everybody has a good time. And we do get big crowds sometimes. So I hope they aren't doing away with it.
Well, so speaking of big crowds, hopefully they'll have a big crowd there Wednesday night Chinatown.
Did you have affairs?
At Mr. Giddy's.
Did he know about it? Where were you when your husband died? You were seeing someone too.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to try to make that one, definitely.
Yeah, that'll be good.
I hope that series has been going well.
Well, I think they'll bring that series back definitely in the fall. They've had over 100 people show up the past 2 or 3 weeks.
Maybe it's some more obscure things. Maybe Gun Crazy. That would be great.
Maybe. But I mean, they showed, what was it, Dark Passage, which was probably the most obscure of the 8 movies that were on this series, and that had the smallest crowd.
Yes.
So it's really the standards that people want to go out and see. And Chinatown, I haven't seen at the theater since it was new. My parents took me, I guess I would have been about 11 years old, and I couldn't understand what the heck was going on in this movie. But it didn't matter. I was sort of mesmerized at the same time. I think it's still sort of an overly complicated film, but it's really great.
Yes.
Yeah, it won the Oscar for Best Screenplay for Robert Towne.
And one of the creepiest performances on film by John Huston.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. He's fabulous.
He is a creep.
Let's see. Yesterday I mentioned this Singing in the Rain with the St. Louis Symphony. They strip out the music and they have the symphony play, and that was great. It's sold out, Mother's Day thing. Jane Lynch is going to be at the symphony a week from Friday. She is best known for being in No Best in Show and Julie and Julia, and what else was she in?
Best in Show, Mighty Wind.
Mighty Wind, she's in a lot of those films.
All the Christopher Guest films.
And then my daughter likes her from Glee.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But she's going to do, apparently she's going to sing with the symphony, but I think it's a comedy. I think it's more of a stand-up comedy combined with singing. I don't know. But I'll let you know because I got free tickets.
Pretty curious.
Lucky me. And then at the Webster U, not only are they showing Whiskey Galore this weekend, but they're showing 10 Twilight Zone episodes on the big screen at Webster U for some reason.
Really?
On Sunday nights beginning June 2nd.
Huh.
2 episodes per night every Sunday night for 5 weeks. Every Sunday in June and then the first Sunday in July. But they haven't announced which episodes they're showing.
Yeah.
It's just on their calendar. I guess it's going to be a surprise. I don't know. I'm going to reach out to James Harrison and see if he can identify those. Maybe they just haven't decided yet. I don't know. But on their website, they do not mention the titles of these episodes.
No, they're not all gems. It's a strong show, but
you'd want to know which episode.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so we did lose a couple of stars. I just want to briefly mention Kenny Miller. Are you guys familiar with Kenny Miller?
I wasn't until you mentioned him and I looked him up.
I just liked Kenny because he really embraced the fact that he had been in a couple of cheesy horror movies back in the 50s, but he would always show up at these conventions. He wasn't even a paid guest. He would just show up at conventions and want to meet people and would never charge. You know, I have an Attack of the Puppet People lobby card signed by him. He would never charge to sign it for his autograph. Super nice guy. He was best known for Attack of the Puppet People and I Was a Teenage Werewolf. He kind of looked they called him the Teenage Red Buttons because he was this real wholesome guy. He also kind of looked like Donnie Most from Happy Days.
The kind of blondish hair in those
movies?
Yeah,
kind of. Probably had red hair.
The strawberry blonde.
Yeah. He was in Touch of Evil, which showed at the Tivoli last week. He was in East of Eden. He had some smaller roles in some major films. But he's best known for those two horror films. And he wrote his autobiography and talked about it. And was just a super nice guy and was always at the conventions. I've been going to these conventions for almost 30 years. And every time I go to one of these things, there was Kenny Miller, and he's just a super nice guy. So RIP to Mr. Kenny Miller. He was, I think he was around 80 years old. Huh. Michael Parks.
Yes.
How old was he? He was 70 something, mid 70s.
72, something.
Yeah, he passed away. Interesting actor.
Yeah, it's weird. I was talking with someone yesterday about one season TV shows and how sometimes they'll stick in people's heads more than the ones that last several years. And he was in one of the most celebrated ones, Then Came Bronson.
And that was
mentioned in most of his obits. And that did only last one season, but it's fondly remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And probably fondly remembered by Quentin Tarantino. Pacino, who then went ahead and cast him in several of his films. And actually, I was surprised that that character, Earl McGraw, is that's the same character from Dust Till Dawn and in Kill Bill and in the Grindhouse films.
Yeah, he was the only character that was in both of the Grindhouse films, I think.
Death Proof.
It was the one character that sort of tied those two stories together. He was also the villain in Death Wish 5. Which starred Charles Bronson in 1994. Then came Bronson. I think it was sort of the TV version of Easy Rider. Easy Rider came out the year before and was this huge hit. And I think the networks decided they wanted to sort of cash in on that, so they came up with this Then Came Bronson, which I think didn't he play like a novelist who just chucked it all and got a motorcycle and went on the road and he just rode around the country meeting people.
Sure, It's sort of an anthology show, I guess. He'd meet different people every week.
Yeah. So. And then, like you say, Tarantino sort of rediscovered him. Dusk to Dawn was the first time that Tarantino put him in one of his films. Tarantino wrote that film.
Yeah. There was a couple other films on his resume. The Happening, which was kind of a big that was by the big studios trying to cash in on the youth craze of the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And Bus Riley's Back in Town, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in Argo.
That's right, playing Jack Kirby, King of Comics.
And he was an assassination of Jesse James by Robert Ford. They showed us Tusk. Tusk was a movie that Kevin Smith wrote and directed, and they showed us a screening of that a couple of years ago. And he was really the star of that. He was the main villain.
Yeah.
And he was quite good. He was really good. He was a good actor.
He was better than the movie, that's for sure.
Yeah. The Red State was another Kevin Smith film that he popped up in. So RIP to that dude, Michael Parks. And just last night, word broke that Powers Booth had passed away at age 68 or 69. He was too young to die. Apparently died in his sleep of natural causes. I didn't know that happened to people in the 60s, but apparently it did. Poor guy. I hadn't seen him on the big screen. You say he was on a superhero show. I hadn't seen him on the big screen much in the past decade, except in those Sin City movies, and he was quite good in those.
Yeah, you could kind of see him in the shadows in the first Avengers film as one of the heads of S.H.I.E.L.D. near the end of the film. But, he was just in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show, and I had down here some of the things he did. I remember him getting his Emmy for playing the Reverend Jim Jones, which was a big deal.
One of his standout performances.
Exactly. But then he followed that up with the Walter Hill film Southern Comfort, as I recall.
Yeah, and I just watched Extreme Order. Prejudice. Oh. I tracked that down just a couple weeks ago. I watched that. That's also Walter Hill.
And he did a wonderful performance in Tombstone.
Yes. And he was in the original Red Dawn.
Yeah.
And he was in Nixon and Blue Sky.
And Frailty. He was in the Emerald Jungle, which was a John Borman film he starred in in the early 80s.
He's a busy actor, bouncing around between TV and films quite a bit the last few years. So.
Yeah.
Talented guy.
I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah. Surprising. Yeah,
quite a loss.
Yes, it was. That's what happens. All right, Jim, we got 1 minute. You wanted to talk about some documentary you saw?
Oh, sure. We could do a quick one there. I saw two great documentaries available on Hulu, the streaming service. I was waiting for one called Batman and Bill to show up, but instead watched one called Doomed. And I think we're just talking about Roger Corman. This was involves him. This involves the 1993 attempt to do a Fantastic Four feature film.
Do they show clips from the film?
They show lots of clips. They have interviews with all the actors.
Now, do the clips look sharp?
Yeah, they're sharp. Certainly better quality than what you would buy at the fantasy.
I've never seen a decent looking copy of that film.
Yeah, the scenes were pretty clear, but it being only the budget for that Fantastic Four film was a paltry $1 million, and you couldn't have done a Fantastic Four film for $1 million in 1973, let alone 1993. So it's an interesting little profile of a film that everyone was really enthused about being involved with, but that never saw the light of day in theaters.
This is a feature length film about the making of that film.
And I think it's probably more entertaining than the 93 film that they're talking about.
Probably. And what was the other one you saw? The
other one is Batman and Me. It's about a fellow named William Finger. Every time you'd see something with Batman, it'd always say Batman created by Bob Kane. Well, Bob Kane came up with the look of Batman and the name, but Bill Finger came up with everything else. Mm-hmm. Bruce Wayne, Gotham City, the Batmobile, everything, and never got credit. And this is about one researcher's attempt to finally establish him as a co-creator of Batman. And it's a detective story. There's some nice animation in it. If you're a fan of the Batman films or the character or whatever, it's a must-see. So take the time to watch
that.
And
that's called Batman and Me?
Batman and Bill.
Batman and Bill. Okay. So look for those two documentaries, and I guess we'll be back next week. What are we going to review next week? Anything?
Everything. Yeah, that's
everything,
about
everything.
It.
Is that what it is?
Unless they show something
everything.
Else to us. Yeah, let's
all right. See. I'm sure there will be other things for us to talk about, and probably more people will die and things
we hope
like
not.
For now, we're going to have to wrap this up. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Kate Marquis.
And be sure to listen again next week.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh, naughty state. Hello, Don.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock. Black leather, kill, I got that feeling. Black leather, rock.
Forward in the battle, there, chaps.
You happy in your work, Johnny?
By the lift!